Welcome back to Siren Radio with me, Jamie Rose. Today, I'm joined by mentor, therapist, inspirational speaker, and I'm not even going to be afraid to say it, personal hero of mine, bred for Lincoln City, Grimsby Town, Mr. Nathan Arnold. How are you today, mate?
I'm very well, Jamie. Thank you for having me.
No, thank you for coming on. The best place to probably start is your childhood. Going all the way back, how was it kind of growing up? Football-wise, you know, your mental health-wise, how was it? How was kind of your childhood growing up?
My childhood was okay. I grew up in a family where there was me, my mum, my nan and my sister. My father was absent. I didn't go on to meet my father till I was 20. And so I was always struggling to kind of understand my identity. Obviously, with not knowing my father for that amount of years, then I struggled at school and just socially, and probably led to me trying to fit in at school and associate myself with people, probably wanting to feel approved of and validation in others. So that was evident early on when I noticed that I was kind of floating around just to try and belong, really. With my home life, it was quite rough in terms of my mum was struggling with her own mental health. She was struggling with depression. She was off work often, and I'd seen that firsthand, the impact that it had on her. And my nan, who I lived with as well, she worked two jobs to provide meals on the table for me and my sister. And the environment itself was quite rough. I'd look over my left shoulder, there was drug dealers, look over my right shoulder, people robbing each other, people in and out of prison. So I learned to be resilient at a young age, and probably was exposed to too much for a young boy, but it definitely helped me in terms of building that resilience. And I definitely think then that bled into my football, which then obviously became really effective.
Yeah, so by all accounts, quite a kind of challenging childhood. I mean, like you say, it's probably a better place to go from there. That coming from that, what was kind of the road to, you know, being in professional football? Was it going into academy? Was it kind of struggling in terms of, you know, trying to fit in, especially when you're kind of playing football, not having maybe a father figure growing up like most kind of lads do, especially when it comes to football? I mean, how was it like? Was it kind of going into academy and then kind of struggling along the way, or was it something that you kind of fell at home with and more adapted by to have a comfort in something like football to guide you?
Yeah, well, actually, it's a good question, because when I look back from my earliest memories, I'd always gravitated to a ball. I mean, even the earliest photos that I have in the family photo album, I was always with a ball, whether that was just a small tennis ball or you know, a normal sized football. But I remember always gravitating to a ball, and I always felt safe with a ball, despite obviously probably feeling a little bit unsettled, probably lacking direction. At school, I wasn't really academically doing really well. I was dysregulated, I would say, because of the home life and the environment and not knowing my father, and my mother obviously with her instability with the mental health as well. I probably at school probably felt a little bit unsettled, like I mentioned. And so whenever I used to gravitate to a ball and knock it against the wall on the street, go and play with my friends, that's when I always felt the most safe, really. And it's sad to say, but that's probably how I felt. And then on one night,
a sense of escapism, maybe.
Yeah, exactly that. So I think with football and how I got into that, it just played out where I was just knocking a ball against the wall one night. And my mum always used to say, when the street lamps come on, that's your cue to come home. And on this one particular night, I remember the street lamps come on. So I went to grab my ball under my arm. And as I was about to go home, I'd seen a car driving up the street. And the closer it got, the slower it became. And it was a guy in a tracksuit, and he wound his window down. And my mum used to always say, you know, don't talk to strangers, all that. So I was pretty wary. And the guy wound his window down and he said, son, can you go and get your guardian for me? And so I went inside and I told my mum and nan that there was a gentleman out outside in a car that he wanted them. So they grabbed their coats and they went out, and the man said to my mother, he said, every night when I leave work to go home or to go football training, I always see your son knocking a ball against the wall. I would like to invite him into organised sport. Now, at that point, this man obviously was a stranger to me, but he was working in the local community. And what he would do is he would go and find local talented players, and he would then go and invite them in for a trial. So from there, obviously with my mum not driving, we didn't have much money. She had a little bit of resistance to that. She didn't know who this man was. So her first word was, you know, sorry, we can't afford it. We can't get him there. We don't drive. It's a great gesture, but on this occasion, we're going to have to turn you down. And it took a little bit of convincing for me to, you know, persuade my mum to let me go. And then the following week, he turned up. He said to my mum in response to that, he said, if you bring your son here this time next week, not only will I take him to him from football, but I'll also pay for his fees as well. And I just thought that was amazing for somebody who didn't know me to give me that opportunity. And clearly he's seen something in me, even if it was just those odd moments driving from work to go home, but he'd spotted me. And I always say to young people, you just never know who's watching. But that moment right there in the street, I call it a meant to be moment, because I don't know where I would have been without football. And I'm not quite sure what path I was on at that time and where that was going to lead to should I have not been given that opportunity. So I think that probably was the first time really that I had an opportunity to pursue football, and I got into organised sport, and then I spent the next 11 years at Mansfield Town having been successful through the trials.
Yeah, was it kind of, for him to kind of take you on, was it that kind of sense of maybe obviously didn't kind of have a father growing up, did he end up being kind of that male guardian for you when you was in the academy and kind of organised sport? Did he end up being kind of a guiding light in terms of something like that, in terms of not having a father? Or was it kind of, as a collective?
Yeah, to a degree, because, I mean, he was working in the football in the community, so he got me the trial, but he was coaching initially at younger ages. But as I got older, he kind of faded into the background, and he was doing a lot of community work. But he was great throughout that period, that 11 years, because he was always somebody I could go to. He was always a mentor, you know. He's the one that spotted me in the street in the first place. So I always felt indebted to Mark and all the stuff that he did. I mean, even when I got to 16 and I was doing work experience, I asked to go and work with him in the community, you know, to give back to the community. I never forgot my roots and that moment. So I worked with him for a little while, and yeah, a special man, special individual. And I think that's probably why I've got a burning desire now to reach back in and help people in the community, especially with the mental health, based on my mother's struggles and certainly some of the struggles that I had later in my 20s.
Yeah, definitely. What was it, just kind of getting on with it, and just kind of when you was playing football, was it just something to keep you grounded and level-headed? Or was there certainly really kind of bad days? I mean, we'll talk about the what happened with your mother, but was there, like, leading up to that, was there certain moments of anxiety maybe coming out where you didn't want to perform your best? Or was it just a case of a distraction in terms of football, and then in later life it became something that you had to kind of deal with in a way?
Yeah, well, I was unaware, because when I was unsettled and I was dysregulated as a child, I mean, all I wanted is safety. And unfortunately, there was some parts of my childhood where I felt really unsafe. My mother was in some rough relationships. The environment that I grew up in, the lack of money, probably lack and limitation mindset as well that we had, I didn't know any different. And so when I started to get into organized sport, I started to develop friendships, and I started to then understand how other people was living. And I noticed that there was people living a little bit different to how we was living. So I started to learn and understand that actually, yeah, we, you know, we are struggling financially a little bit. And maybe that played out in some of my behaviors, like at school, for example. I would always have to sit at the back, and I'd always have to see the whole room and know who's there. And I'd really feel uncomfortable if I was sat at the front, but often at times, because of my surname, Arnold, sometimes alphabetical order, I sat at the front. And I can remember feeling really unsettled because, obviously, maybe the way that things were playing out unconsciously for me. And then that would lead for me to be disruptive in class. And often at times I'd do things so I'd get sent out in isolation just because I really struggled in that environment. So it wasn't my true nature, but I used to behave a certain way. And when I look back in reflection, that's definitely something to do with a wound and how my childhood played out that way. So football was always an escape, a release for me, and I didn't know that until my later years, really, back end of my career.
Yeah, and there's one that really, I think, sticks out, and that's probably, with, if you don't mind me saying, kind of the sudden death of your mum. I mean, you say about a struggling, but I just saw something where I think you gave an interview to the to Lincoln Live where you say that you that entire season pretty much, what was it like halfway through the season that your mother passed away, and then you struggled all the way through that season with Lincoln. I mean, talk to me about that, really, because that's not something, because you got such a high with football, because I think you're going for a promotion that year. And then talk to me about kind of the low of that and how it just ended up being management, because surely it's going to be hard to go out there and perform your best when something that traumatic has happened.
Yeah, sure. When I was younger, I was, again, exposed to certain things that probably children shouldn't be exposed to. I would often find my mother drinking, and she used to do it in private, but obviously I was aware of that. But for many years, really from a really young age, I remember her addiction with alcohol, and it just got worse as I got older. Of course, when I became a professional footballer at 17, 18 years old, I started out at Mansfield Town, and then I had various different clubs. And so when I moved to play for Cambridge, I wouldn't be home often enough. And I started to visit, and then it was noticeable, because I wasn't spending a lot of time with my family, that the weight was dropping off, and I could see definitely there was something going on with a mental health declining. And so I put intervention in place, and, you know, I spoke to the doctors and got her assessed at home. My mother was very, and with alcoholics, they tend to be very, you know, very much resistant to getting the help. And sometimes it's difficult, especially if you're a family member, to try and provide that support. And I remember there was numerous occasions where I tried to get my mother help, and there was a lot of denial in there. And so it got to a stage where I felt like I'd exhausted every avenue, and it was really my mother's choice. And I think when it got to the latter part, I was at Grimsby when my mother passed away. And when I look back, there was signs throughout her life that there was something not right. But of course, when you are uneducated, or maybe you don't know what to look out for in terms of the signs, then yeah, we certainly missed a few things. And it got to a point where there was a point of no return. So the latter stages of my career started at Grimsby. And then I struggled a little bit towards the back end of that season. But because we'd got promotion, and I scored at Wembley, and we got to the FA Trophy final, football, because it was an escape, you kind of then, you're on autopilot. And I didn't grieve through that that period of time. I didn't process my mother's death properly. And then when I went to Lincoln in the following summer, because I didn't grieve, again, football, it was a successful season. And it really started to take its toll after Christmas, really. And obviously, we had a backlog of fixtures. You know, we had amazing run in the FA Cup. And so I always say I felt like a public success, but private failure. You know, on the pitch, it was a highly successful time in my career. But then going home to my reality, I felt like I was struggling. So it was really at the back end of that season with Lincoln, my first season at Lincoln City, where everything caught up with me. And I really started to process grief. And that's when the chronic anxiety came in, and that's when I was diagnosed with that towards the end.
Yeah, and I was there when Grimsby went up against Forest Green, and that goal, which is just an incredible moment. But now, kind of you saying about the loss of your mum, I can remember your scoring and that kind of crying into the air, is that kind of an output of emotion in the moment, or is that from a personal standpoint, or is that a professional standpoint? And that kind of, and I think there was a point where you got kind of emotional coming off the pitch. Was that personal, or was that something to do with pride, or a little bit of both?
I think it was definitely emotional release, because when you are at football, you learn to just wear the mask. You learn to get on with it. It's result orientated. I did very well at just shutting everything off and getting tunnel vision, just focusing on my job, my task in hand. And it provided me with that escapism, which in a way I thought at the time was really helpful. And what I now know is that all I was doing is suppressing those emotions. So I think when I'd scored that goal, there was a relief, because I'd built amazing relationships with the people at Grimsby as well. And the year before, we'd lost to Bristol Rovers at Wembley on penalties. And so the following season, there was relief of, you know, it's been a 6-year wait. I think it was 5 or 6 years as in the conference Grimsby. I know what it meant to the town and the people in the community. So I was really proud and really happy and joyous for them. And also from a professional point of view, of course, it was an amazing achievement. So there was a lot of that. But I think majority of that season, there was a lot of emotions that just poured out of me in that moment, through to, you know, what was going on at home in private with my mother. So yeah, a lot of emotions that year. And you know, and that's probably where I started to then face it and actually start to look at getting some support with that, you know, with a therapist.
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of going from the promotion at Lincoln, and then you do the run in at Lincoln, and the goal at Ipswich as well, at Sinsel Bank. So you've had a kind of an amazing, you know, 18 month or so, really. But like in the background, it's very much a bit of a kind of mess for you in terms of your mental health, etc. So kind of, when do you go and, you know, seek professional help, and when do you try and, I know that you're into kind of your meditation, etc. as well. When do you kind of get into that? When does it shift towards you dealing with this grief and dealing with your anxiety? Where does it kind of start for people?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, my own personal experience, when we got to the quarterfinals of the FA Cup and we got promotion that season, I played 50 plus games and I was mentally, physically and emotionally exhausted. And I remember getting invited onto the BBC Radio Lincolnshire, and I was speaking about the promotion. I was speaking about some of the amazing experiences that we had that season. But for some reason, what just came through me was for me to just be authentic. And I just started to speak my truth and exactly how I was feeling. And it's difficult in football because, I mean, it's more open now, but at the time, it can almost jeopardise your position in football or in the workplace, because, you know, you can be perceived to that you've got mental health issues and that's a bit of a negative. And so I was very reluctant to share how I was feeling, especially in my professional life. But I remember taking the opportunity that morning on break on BBC Radio Lincolnshire to talk about it. And it's probably the best thing and best decision I ever made, because off the back of that, within 4 days, I had 60 people reach out on social media, and they were driving on the breakfast show, just driving to work, and they heard my interview, and I had some lovely, really supportive messages from the Lincoln supporters and Grimsby supporters. Some of them say, me too, I can resonate and relate to your story. And so spontaneously, it was just something instinctive in me. I went to Dan Cowley and I just said, look, can I get a function room at Lincoln City? And I said, I want to put on a workshop. I'd never done a workshop before. I didn't know what one looked like. But I just felt I had a duty now to then go and put on a session for these 60 people to talk about anxiety, talk about mental health issues. And I think on the back of my mother's death as well, I felt like I had a responsibility then to also, because I'd missed the signs with my mother as well, that because I'd seen the impact that it had on my own mental health too, that I wanted to then learn about, you know, some of those signs and to go through that uncomfortable process of of grieving and coming through the other side. So that initial workshop was the very first starting point of doing the work that I've done now over 6 years.
Yeah, and you've kind of gone into your motivational talking and speaking and your therapy and all that. But that was kind of the start. And then when do you kind of, you say that you have this kind of duty of care to, because of this interview that goes out on BBC Links, that goes out, when do you kind of then have your own person, when you go to a professional and talk to about it, because you've kind of invited other people in for this workshop, when do you kind of have that moment where you think, okay, now I need kind of, or do you kind of find it with an outlet anyway? Do you not really go to a professional? Is it more of an outlet to help other people and that's your way of grieving and that's your way of kind of getting over it? Or is it a case of, okay, now I'm going to speak to a professional, speak to a therapist? Or was it just a case of helping other people and that was your way of getting through it?
Yeah, it's a great question again, because for the majority of my life, I had, so my auntie, even at my teenage years and early, adolescence, early adult life, I got very good at being able to brace myself when a panic attack arrived and deal with it. And clearly that stemmed from, me being dysregulated, not feeling safe as a child and everything that I was exposed to and experienced. But at the time when I was dealing with panic attacks, I developed this kind of shame and embarrassment, because they wouldn't last long. And also I can remember the impact that it was having on people around me who was worried about, the way that I was feeling. And so I remember feeling a lot of shame around it. And so what I tended to do was just to suffer in silence, really, and in private. I wouldn't talk about the way that I was feeling growing up. Obviously, that became more intense as I got older, and when I lost my mum, and through the grieving process, I developed chronic anxiety, which was diagnosed. And I've said this on many podcasts, but there was often at times throughout my career where the paramedics would come out, or I would take myself off to A&E, and my family wouldn't know about it. There was one time when I got in my car 2 a.m. in the morning, I waited for everybody to go to sleep, they was in bed, and I took myself off because I was having heart palpitations, and I just was really restless, I couldn't sleep. And I remember taking myself off to A&E, and at the time I was playing for Lincoln City. And I took myself off to the hospital, and when I was in the car park going into the entrance, I put on a limp because I thought, well, if anybody sees me from Lincoln, then I can just pass it off that I'm injured and that I've just come to get some treatment. And the truth was that I was really struggling with my mental health. But there was so many times when the paramedics or the doctors would come and reassure me that I'm fit and healthy and I'm free to go. And I just never understood how I could be fit and healthy but feel so terrible. And so when I talk about, and to answer your question in terms of how did I go and reach out for my own mental health, because there was a lot of shame around that, I didn't actually go and seek it. So Mark, who spotted me in the street, who gave me an opportunity with football, there was two other people in my life that kind of just, I call them angels because they just appeared out of nowhere. And there was Mark who invited me into football. There was a lady at school who is still to this day I speak to, who's an amazing lady. And also there was the chairman's wife called Glenice. So we'd gravitate after a game at Lincoln. We'd go upstairs, we'd meet some of the supporters, and we'd spend time with family before we go home. And on this one occasion, this lady, Glenice, came up to me. I started to develop a good relationship with her. I'd often speak to her. And she just one day just came out of the blue. She said, she signposted me to this guy called Philip Underwood in Lincoln. And at that time, I'd been through counselling and I wasn't getting on with it. And I was kind of at a loss. And she said, just go and see this man. She gave me his card. And I thought, right, okay, I'm at a loss. I've got nothing to lose. So I'll go and see him. And he was a 74-year-old man, lived in Lincoln, and he did his therapy sessions at home. And I went to see him, and he gave me some really life-changing tools. He worked closely with me for about 3 years, and I got my qualifications. I learned how I was doing anxiety. I worked to heal myself.
And when you mentioned meditation, I also went on a Vipassana, which was a 10-day meditation retreat. And I started to do the work whilst I was still at Lincoln City. I started to read the books. I started to get clued up on mental health and how I was obviously dealing with that. And then, yeah, along the way, I was doing talks in schools. I got invited to do motivational talks in schools, colleges, universities. It started really small, and I started to do the public speaking. But then after my qualifications, then I started to set up my own therapy service, my mentoring service. I started to run six-week mentoring programs at HMP Lincoln for the prisoners. And it started to just grow and evolve naturally. So it all stemmed from really not me seeking mental health support, but almost falling into it, if you like.
Yeah. Is that another, seeing this man that was kind of doing home therapy, was that another meant to be a moment, would you say, in your life? So it was seeing him kind of being looked at, being kind of scouted from the streets and then invited into kind of organised football, and then seeing this man, is that another kind of meant to be in your life that kind of sticks out as one of them moments along your journey that is kind of this a canon event in terms of your kind of mental health and your way of living?
Yeah, definitely. How I see my life is that because I grew up without a father for 20 years, I feel really privileged to have met certain people who have been really significant in my life. There's only a handful of people along my journey, but they've almost came into my life at the time when I've needed them. And now I speak to them every day, every other day, every other week, and I'm still in contact with them. And so they're almost like an extended family. I didn't have a granddad either. I didn't know my Jamaican side on my mother's side. And then my granddaddy has passed away when I was born. So I feel like, yeah, there's certain people in my life that I could lean on, I could go and reach into, I could speak to and develop those relationships. So although I was, just me, my mum and dad and my sister growing up, and I only had a small family, I feel like I've built a family over time with these people that have come into my life. So I'm really fortunate. I feel really blessed to know these people. But definitely with my life coach at the time, he definitely helped me at a time where I just felt, at the time I was a footballer, everything was going well, I was successful. And so I didn't really, have that time to reflect on my life as a whole. And I thought he walked me through that process really well. And that's something that I pride myself on when I support people now with my services, is to walk, by their side and guide them and assist them and give them the tools that they need to overcome whatever's playing out for them. So I feel like I've learned a lot in that period throughout my own personal experiences, and that's then held me in good stead to do the work what I do now.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is amazing what you do. It is absolutely extraordinary what you do.
I just
always knew as kind of with I don't want to be kind of too forward with it, but I always thought it was the player that scored at Wembley that put Tan into the Football League and then scored against Ipswich at Sinsel Bank and did this amazing cup run with Lincoln. But it's kind of, this is probably the most important interview that I think I'll ever do in terms of maybe retracting what goes on behind the scenes. I think it's really important to kind of talk about it as well. And just kind of, I mean, you talk about while you were playing football, you were struggling. I just, and I'd love to kind of have your opinion on this. A lot of people will say exercise and sport is the best way to deal with your mental health. Did you find that was true because you're playing, you're training every day, you're exercising every day, you're keeping fit because you're a professional footballer? Was that something where you was like, it's not helping me? Professional help or something, another outlet that isn't your day-to-day job. Is that kind of interesting, would you say, or would you still say that, the keeping fit would have, it's kept you from, falling deeper into maybe anxiety and depression? Was kind of keeping fit and at least having a focus in your professional job. What would you say about that?
Yeah, it's a good point you make. I definitely think that exercise is obviously a real positive for people's mental health. So I definitely encourage people to exercise. But as long as you're in control of it, and it's not in control of you,
yeah,
you know, if you're going to the gym or if you're getting obsessed with working out constantly, but that's just providing you with a distraction, then that's unhealthy. I did distraction really well, and I think football was a really good concoction for me because I'd go for an hour and a half across the white line, I'd go and play football, I had all this adrenaline. Of course, when I've done the work now, I understand that when you have a dysregulated nervous system, then you're in fight or flight. So when you're in fight or flight, you know, you've got all these chemicals running around your body, hence why obviously I had chronic anxiety. If anybody's had a panic attack, ever experienced one, then you just want to flee. You know, you want to get out of there. Yeah. And so football, because there was all this adrenaline involved, and of course that was a really good way of releasing all these, you know, suppressed emotions, if you like. But what I've learned is that there is a healthier way. There's a better way of doing it. And you can actually regulate your nervous system whilst playing, whilst under pressure. And it's not healthy long term, and I've experienced that where I kind of pushed everything, you know, brushed everything under the carpet, pushed everything aside, and just thought that I could go out onto the pitch and all my problems would fall away. But because we're human, once obviously I've come away from that environment, then there's a lot of things to deal with internally that have probably been there a long, long time. It wasn't just stemmed from my mother's death, but there was a lot of trauma and a lot of wounds, inner child wounds that played out, you know, from a very young age. So to answer your question, yeah, definitely exercise can be a real benefit for your mental health, but sometimes it acts like a weed killer. If you used to go in your garden, just spray weed killer, yeah, you're not getting to the root. So, you know, the weeds are going to grow back. You need to get to the root cause.
Yeah.
You need to get to the root and pull it out. And often at times I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't get to the root because it was uncomfortable. Maybe I didn't have time to, you know, to go and look at all my life and deal with it, because football, you're busy constantly. But I definitely encourage people, and that's the work that I do now. I co-host a podcast with two other guys, and we talk about this regularly, how we can get people to perform at their best and to deal with stressful situations and pressurized moments effectively with the practical tools that we provide for them. So I certainly think that there's it serves a purpose, definitely, but you need to be able to have the tools to be able to sustain that, you know, healthily.
Yeah. So do you think in terms of exercising, it definitely provides a positive, but because of the kind of stress that you've played under and the duress that, you know, you're faced with as a professional footballer, had the adverse effect in a way, would you say?
Yeah, because I end up just burning out, you know. You just end up getting to burnout because there's only so long that you can sustain that for. And especially with the intensity and the schedule and the fixture pile-up and the pressure and the, you know, if you look at the Lincoln City season and the Grimsby one before, even before that, when I was at Cambridge, I got promotion three times in four seasons. So prior to Grimsby, I was at Cambridge. We did the double, went to Wembley, won the FA Trophy, and then won promotion. Grimsby got to the playoff final to Bristol Rovers, lost on penalties, and the following season we went to the FA Trophy final, and then promotion with Grimsby, and then Lincoln with the FA Cup quarterfinals, and then promotion again.
You wasn't short of success yet. It still didn't feel as fulfilling as it probably should have been. Is that what you mean in terms of?
It was fulfilling, but just in terms of, I was very much at the right end of the table with those clubs. So what I was saying is that there's a lot of responsibility on us as players to produce and to deliver. Yeah. And because we were in high pressurized moments, you know, there was playoff finals, there was FA Cup quarterfinals, there was, you know, the going for the league title, there was games the back end of that season with Lincoln where we just crawled over the line in games. So going back to your mental health and the exercise and all of that, then because you've got all this adrenaline, because you're on autopilot, you don't really pay attention to that. You're not aware of it. And it's only until you come up for air and you exhale and actually have time to reflect that you realize, you know, that actually what you've been doing is you've been distracting yourself for so long. And you've just been getting through it. I can remember games where I just take Diclofenix, you know, to just get me through the pain or injuries just back end of that season, and then your body takes an absolute hammering, but mentally as well what it's doing. And so when it comes to, yeah, when it comes to, you know, being able to perform at your best and to avoid that burnout, then you need to have those practical tools. You need to often speak about what's playing up, you know, playing out for you emotionally. And that's something that we're pushing now with this podcast and the project that we've got. We're very much trying to, you know, reach out to athletes and sports teams and football clubs and make sure that these things are in place so people can sustain, you know, that level of performance and make sure that their mental health doesn't derail in this, you know, in the meantime.
Yeah, absolutely. What's the podcast called for people to hear that? What's the podcast called?
So it's called The Playmaker Within. So it's not published yet. We've okay. recorded our first three episodes, which will be going out pretty soon. But I'll do a little bit of promotion around that once, yeah. obviously, it's out. But this is something we got together. We've got a lot of synergy and overlaps. There's another guy who used to play for Tottenham Hotspur and got released at a very young age, at 17, and another guy who's co-hosting the podcast as well, who's working with academy footballers, you know, at a really high level. So I feel like we've got a 360 view on things, and it's going to be really beneficial and really important to get this work out that we're doing, because I think from my own personal experiences, I look back and I think I'm really privileged to have experienced and had the career that I carved out for myself, in terms of the, you know, the promotions that I've had and the experiences that I had. But I just wonder how much better off I would have been if there was some tools in place and there was all this support involved in, you know, with footballers at the time. I just feel like I would have probably had a better career, and I probably would have ended up playing football for a lot longer than I did when I come away from it at 30.
Yeah, I was going to say you retired very early to go into management, but before we kind of talk about that, is there any regrets that you have? Do you regret your career in a way? Is there any kind of standout moments that you regret, or is it something that you look back over fondly and say, no, I did what I could. I did what I could. I tried my heart out. I played my heart out. I played with everything that I could. Or is there still things that you now you're retired and you're going into this that you look into and you go, nah, maybe that will stand out as a little bit of a regret? Is there any?
Yeah, it's kind of twofold, because I think initially there was regret. There was regret that I didn't live in the moment more, and I didn't celebrate. I was an intense player. I was always driven, and so I wasn't satisfied. So I probably needed to learn to celebrate the small wins more. I needed to enjoy my football more and play with a smile on my face. I was very intense. I took my football very seriously, but probably took myself too seriously too. But it just meant so much. So when I look back on photos, when I look back on videos, and we're celebrating, champagne spraying, I just wish I got involved more. I was a bit more of a lad, and I really embraced that, because those times just come and go. And you've worked so hard to get to that point to achieve that. And so I think probably just loosened up a little bit. But then, because it's twofold, I think it's gone from regret to actually having self-compassion. Because I think, if I'm honest with myself, the reason why I probably didn't jump into the middle of the, you know, the celebrations is probably because of the way that I was feeling internally. You know, I felt really terrible. I had chronic anxiety. And there was one video that I put on my social media where I pointed out, it was actually Macclesfield when we'd got promotion, and I rang Dan up in the morning and I tried to get out of playing. I mean, who gets out of playing in a promotion? You know, we've got one game away from winning the league, and, you know, it'd be everybody's dream. People would play with one leg, you know, and I must have felt that bad for me to try and get out of playing that day.
Yeah, and I think you put it up on Instagram, the celebrations. And there's kind of you looking very kind of out the way, in a way, and everyone's kind of celebrating the banners that say promotion, the champagne spraying, and you're kind of very much out the way. And I think you posted that on your Instagram.
That's right, yeah. And that's why I say it's twofold, because the compassion comes in, because I actually feel really sad about that, because I felt like I deserved to get amongst my teammates and embrace that. Football's a very short career, and those moments come and go. And that was like a blink, you know, in a blink it was over. And so when you're in the thick of it, you don't really think too much about that. You don't think about life after football and you know, and it's gone for a long time. And so there's a little bit of sadness there when I look back and think, gosh, yeah, I must have really been going through some hard times not to celebrate that. And I was so happy for the cooks, the cleaners, the management, the volunteers, the kit man, the staff, everybody on my teammates. I was so happy in that moment because it was my third promotion in four seasons. And I helped another club get promotion. You know, it's been a while since it was out of the Football League. And I'm a people person. So every club that I've been at, I've tried to form those relationships with people in the community. And because whatever club I've played for, I've always moved there and I've lived and got a feel for the town or the city, then I think that probably is the reason why I was so passionate and so driven to succeed, is because it wasn't just about me and my achievements and it was just another, you know, another promotion on my CV. It was everything that came with it. And yeah, so there was, to answer your question with that one, first it was regret of, you know, not celebrating those wins and embracing living in the moment. But then in reflection, how could I have when I was dealing with what I was?
Yeah, absolutely. Was there any, was the players aware that any of this was going on, or was it keeping very restricted within you? Was captains, maybe Disley, for etc., was Disley aware of it, being the captain of the team? Or was it kind of something that you just kept within yourself so that no one was ever kind of putting their arm around you and being like, you know, come on, mate, and maybe is that a kind of regret not maybe reaching out and embracing the team bonding? Or maybe you did, I don't know.
Yeah, so when I was at Grimsby and my mother passed away, I was house sharing. So I had a house in Grimsby and I moved one of the players in, Padraig Hammond, striker.
Yes.
So Pudge came to live with me for a season and we became really close friends. And it was at a time when I was, you know, and I'd lost my mother. So around about that period, I then went home. I spoke to Paul Earth, the manager. He said, you know, go and spend time with family, take as much time as you need off. So I went back and I was in hospital for about 17 days with my mother. And so I had a while off football and I was by my mother's bedside. And then I went straight back to football after she'd passed away. And one of the challenging things looking back was that people around you, when you lose somebody and you're going through a bereavement, sometimes people don't know what to say to help. So sometimes they don't say anything at all. Or they could be saying something just to be seen to be saying something to support you. And I really felt for Podge in that moment because it couldn't have been easy for him living under my roof and I'm going through that. So he was a real good help and support. So often we'd go out for a meal and he'd try and, you know, get me out of the house because obviously I was down and I was, you know, trying to come to terms with this new normal of mine. And so he did really well at, you know, getting me out and talking about it and really supporting. Everybody at Grimsby that year was really supportive of me. I remember my first game, it gives me goosebumps every time I think about it, because probably even though I've got the medals and, you know, and some of the goals I've scored and the promotions, especially, you know, getting to the quarterfinals of the FA Cup, making history, one of my most standout moments in my career was the first game back after I lost my mother. So we had the funeral and then I went straight back to football and we played Gateshead at home under the lights on a Tuesday night at Blundell Park. And I didn't know how I would be mentally, physically. I'd not drank, I'd not eaten, I'd not fueled myself. And I'd kind of jumped straight back in. And I'd scored two goals. I don't know where I got the power or the energy from, but I'd scored two goals. We won 2-1. And it was actually one of the best performances of my career. And so that was a real proud moment for me. And the teammates, when I look back at the celebrations and the goals and the highlights of that game, my teammates were just so amazing with me, you know, and the manager and the management team, everybody, the supporters, everyone was just amazing that night. It was incredible. And it actually makes me emotional because there's more to it than football. And in those moments there, when I needed all the support I could get, I certainly got that. And so going back to your question, yeah, I had a lot of players that really did help me, especially at Lincoln as well. When I'd come out on the radio and started to talk about it, you know, there was a lot of players that came up to me speaking about it, didn't have a clue that I was feeling the way I was. Dan and Nick Cowley was amazing with me. And we had a guy called Jim Brearley as well, who was a guy who was working on behalf of the football club who players could go to in private. So that was a really good setup as well at Lincoln City. But just to finish off with that, for many years, I wasn't authentic. In football, you have to be a lad. You have to suck it up. You have to get on with it. You're like a chameleon. You can adapt to different environments. You're thick-skinned. And this just develops over time with being a footballer. That's just the nature of it. And I remember when I was about 27, 28, I was at Lincoln City, and the lads would be playing cards and poker at the back of the bus. And I would then, for the first time, because normally I'd float around those kind of, you know, clicks. And what I'd found myself doing is reading at the front of the bus and journaling and just getting my thoughts onto paper. And just, you know, I probably got some foreign looks from my teammates at the time because I wasn't kind of being a lad and fitting in, but I'd give myself permission to just be me. And for the first time, probably throughout my career at 27, I allowed myself to be my true authentic self in that environment, which was really empowering, really liberating. And I think something that, off the back of a bereavement, probably led to me, yeah, just being myself, really.
Yeah. I'll ask you, and this could be completely wrong, but do you find that some people say that football can be a slightly toxic masculine environment? Do you find that, or do you think that is an attachment that is just so not deserved? Like you say with Patrick Hammond and all that, and it kind of, you're saying that some of the lads was a little bit when we were playing poker, but most of the time we're kind of putting their arm around you. Do you find it to be a slightly kind of toxic environment when you're playing football because of the laddish culture around it, or do you think that's a stigma that is just uncalled for?
I think there's definitely space for more conversations, more meaningful conversations, to create more safety. The problem with football you've got, at the top, management is a very slippery slope. You're only 6 or 7 games away from, you know, getting the sack. So if you think about managers, they're often dysregulated because their job isn't safe. And so sometimes under pressure, when things aren't going well, then of course that can filter down into the changing rooms. You know, as a player itself, that's unsafe as well, because if you've got a year contract, you know that your contract's coming to an end. You're going to be on the scrap heap again in the summer. You're relying on your agent to find you a club. You need to pay the bills, especially if you've got a family and you've got children. You know, it's very unsettling. There's a lot of pressure on you to perform and deliver. There's a pressure on you as well, you know, not to get injured, because that obviously can then play its part. There's all the time when you're playing football, it's the most amazing time, because, you know, you're with your teammates. There's some incredible experiences that you have. You know, a lot of fun, a lot of laughs behind the scenes. You're doing what you love to do. So, you know, I never will complain whatsoever. I think I was really privileged and fortunate to have a career in football. But I definitely think there's space and room for people to start having those conversations, to create those spaces where people can talk about their feelings safely and not be judged. I definitely think when it comes to authenticity as well, that's something that needs to improve. When you mention the word toxic, it's interesting because often that word gets thrown out. Since I've done the work, what I see toxic to be now is just wounds. So, you know, if there's toxic environments or toxic behaviour, then all it is basically a cry for help. So some people will behave a certain way. I see footballers behave in a certain way. You know, you look at Dele Alli, for instance, he probably had people perceived him, they had a perception that he was a bad boy. He had a bad attitude when things weren't going his way, especially when he had a bad period and a blip in his career. And then he comes out and talks about his childhood. So I think what we need to get better at is is noticing the signs, and normally those signs are through people's behavior. So if there's a player that's probably, you know, a bit of a bad boy, let's say, or if a player is perceived to be swimming against the tide, you know, dragging his heels, the manager is saying he's not manageable, he's not coachable. I think there's more of those, there's more work to do within football to identify that actually they're only human and behaviour doesn't define who they are underneath everything. And it's about putting things in place where players can actually feel safe enough to deal with those. Because if they don't deal with those issues, then they're not going to maximise their true potential. And that's what probably I look back at my career and think, I wonder if I could have played at a higher level if I had these things in place and I could then be regulated and I wasn't, you know, I wasn't derailed with my mental health. So there's all those questions, and that's why I'm doing the work now with football and just with people in general, so people can be at their best.
Yeah, absolutely. You retired at 30, but how does that come about? You just got to 30 and just thought, I need time to be myself? Or was it just like, I've done what I wanted to do, I'm struggling, did you want to go off while you were playing football? Did you want to go off and do the kind of motivational speaking and the therapy and the mentorship? Did you want to do art and the workshops, even when you were playing? Was that what you wanted to do next? Or was it a case of, I don't want to play football anymore, I'm retired at 30? Because it's a remarkably young age to retire at in football. So can you talk to me about your retirement and you then transitioned into a little bit of management as well. So kind of talk to me about that. Did you want to go into management to have the same impact as other people had on you?
Okay, really good question. When it comes to start at the front end, so when it comes to retirement, I didn't officially make an announcement, but I felt it was a voluntary retirement. Now there's two. There's voluntary retirement and forced retirement. Unfortunately, there's forced retirement where players fall out of the game, you know, and it's out of their control, maybe through an injury or condition, whatever that may be, illness. I feel fortunate in a way that I volunteered to retire because I felt like I had more control of my decisions and I had a bit more of a clear picture as to what I was going into. But I think if I'm really honest with myself, if somebody said to me at the age of 25, even 27 when I was at Grimsby, that I was going to stop playing at 30, I wouldn't believe you. I wouldn't believe anybody. I thought I was going to continue to play. I mean, I'm 36 now. I played in a charity match yesterday and I still miss it and I enjoy playing and I probably still could compete if I got myself fit.
Nathan, have you still got it? Do you reckon you could go into League Two now? And was you kind of playing and thinking, I reckon I could go back and do a job for Town now or Lincoln? Was you kind of playing and thinking, yeah, I can do a decent shift? Or was you just like,
yeah, maybe of course, I am bad. You never lose it, but I think underneath you've got to want it. You know, you've got that passion, that desire. That drive has got to be there. And I always said I would never do football a disservice. If I ever got to a point in my career where my heart wasn't in it 100%. My heart's still in it now, you know, but not 100%. And I think that, you know, there's a lot of players that would snatch your hand off to be a footballer. And so I wouldn't abuse that privilege. If I wasn't fully committed to it, then, and I suppose that was kind of playing into it. But when I was 30, I'll be honest with you, and I've not said this to many, and probably just because I didn't, you know, I wasn't open and honest about my transition from football to this line of work. But there was a period of time at Lincoln City where I still had a year left on my contract when I was 30. And I came out on the breakfast radio show talking about all these mental health issues that I had and experienced. And what a lot of people don't know is that there was the South African consortium that came in, Clive Nates. And so there was a bit of a transition at the top, if you like, as well, when we got promotion into League Two. And because obviously I'd gone publicly speaking about my mental health issues, then people was aware of it, people at the football club, etc. And so one thing that I didn't understand is that I was going to sign an extension on my contract. And I think it was me and Matt Reed at the time that was going to sign an extension. And those conversations had taken place. The figures had been agreed. And I was ready to commit to, you know, my future to Lincoln. And off the back of the radio show, I believe there was maybe a conversation upstairs that I had some mental health issues and they just wanted to monitor me before they gave me this new contract. Now, looking back, that's kind of discriminative because, you know, you discriminate against someone who's potentially got, you know, mental health issues with the support. But at the same time, you know, it is a business. And so I've probably seen the political side of it, the harshness of football behind the scenes of that. And I suppose that's what drives me now to make sure that support's in place behind closed doors in football clubs, because I felt that although I was supported at the front end, the manager was brilliant with me, the players were brilliant with me, I just felt at the top there was maybe question marks whether I was recovered mentally from that. And probably there was a bit of truth in that, you know, because I look at my performances towards the back end of my career at Lincoln and they probably dipped a little bit. I was in and out of the team. And yeah, that played a part, but definitely probably my attitude and my mindset had changed because I heard those conversations taking place. And probably if I felt a little bit more supported with my mental health, then I probably would have been in a much better, healthier place. So there was that. But the reason why I said it was a voluntary retirement is because when I did the mental health workshop through word of mouth, things just literally took off like a rocket. So all the schools in Lincoln was emailing me, can you go and come and give talks? So I was doing assemblies, colleges, universities. And within a blink of an eye, I've gone and done public speaking. And it's quite strange because I had chronic anxiety and I end up speaking on stage in front of, you know, hundreds of kids in assemblies. I mean, I've spoken to countless people now over the years, thousands and thousands of organizations and people with my business. And it's probably, people say when you're struggling with chronic anxiety, what was it like playing in front of 60,000 at the Emirates or 10,000 at Central Bank? That never fazed me because I was competent with football. I was conditioned to do it and I could just shut everything off. But when you're speaking on stage, motivational speaking, and you're engaging, you're talking about real important matters, it's a completely different perspective. And so, yeah, it was quite interesting how I chose that line of work, having chronic anxiety. I probably could have chose a bit more of a comfortable career after football. But the messages are more important. And this life work that I've committed to is so much more important than me feeling anxious about that. Obviously, I've got the tools now. The first year when I came away from football, I didn't have the tools. I was going on stage. I was having heart palpitations. I was still anxious. I kind of hid that well. I was still nervous going into because it was all new to me. But obviously now I'm established, and you know, for many years now, I've had the tools to be able to, you know, come away from that. On my website, it says, you know, performing in front of 60,000 people whilst battling with chronic anxiety, I reclaim my life beyond the stadium, and that's exactly how I'd see it. Really, I reclaim my life because I was really struggling at the back end.
Absolutely. So, do you feel like life for you began after football in a certain way?
Yeah, I think football was all I ever knew, but I see it as like a vehicle. It was a vehicle to get me to where I am today, and I'm so grateful that on that journey, and football served as a vehicle, that I've met some incredible people. It was only yesterday when you realise, when I've gone back, you know, the Bradford Fire, it's coming up to nearly the 40-year anniversary, so I was kindly invited back to play in a charity match yesterday. And, you know, when the stewards are still there and the stewards are coming up to me, I remember, you know, the moment you took it around the keeper at Ipswich, and we're sharing little experiences that we had.
Yeah.
That's what makes football special and makes me look back on my career and think, even though I do miss it and I enjoy it, and I probably could go back in and compete, that I'm fortunate that actually when I've come away from my career, I've got something to remember.
Yeah.
And I've had those experiences, those moments that I can share with people. And I can, you know, go back to my old clubs and we can still talk about some special moments that we shared. So I don't have any regrets on the whole. I'm really fortunate the career that I had. But going into this line of work now, it's equally as the feeling that I had with football is the equal that I get with my business and helping people.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll ask you this one question. I mean, I'm at uni and I kind of struggle a lot in terms of being the best version of me. Maybe I'm, I struggle to kind of always have that focus and, that passion and the motivation to keep going at the worst of times sometimes when it's kind of, it all feels a little bit kind of low. What would you say is your kind of advice on people that are kind of struggling with their mental health and trying to be the best version of you? What would you say is probably the best thing to go about and do?
Yeah, I think first and foremost is to show yourself compassion, because I think, we all want to aspire to be somebody, to do something with our lives. And often at times when we're feeling a certain way, we can beat ourselves up, or we don't know why we lack motivation, or we just can't click into gear. And so, when I talk about your nervous system, if you've got a dysregulated nervous system, even to the stage in your autonomic nervous system, there's a thing called dorsal, which is actually a mobilization where people do lack motivation. It's a freeze state and they actually find it hard to actually get anywhere, to move forward with their life. And I think it's important to show yourself compassion, because we're not taught this. Nobody talks about it in school. There's so many subjects at school that are just, for me, my own personal opinion, are unnecessary. There's things that at school that I learned that I don't ever need. I've never used it in my life. I'll never need it. But, there's things like when it comes to your mental health, how the way that you're processing your thoughts, how to handle your emotions. We're not taught all this. And it's not the school's fault. They're not taught it either. Teachers aren't taught it, parents aren't taught it, but it needs to be embedded and it needs to be implemented in schools for things to change. So the advice would be to show yourself compassion, that you're only human. And I think it's important as well to let life touch you. I think a lot of the time you will distract yourself, you'll brush things under the carpet, and because it's painful, and if you are a pain avoider naturally as a human, then of course you don't want to be with your feelings, because it's, it's something that you want to avoid. But what I would say is to people is let life touch you. Yes, it's painful, but it's so important for you to feel and for you to be with your emotions and understand how you feel and what's coming up for you. And I think the worst thing is when you try and avoid it, when you try and be positive all the time, that's toxic positivity. When you tell yourself you're not actually being true to how you're feeling and that it's okay to have those moments where things aren't necessarily going how you expect them to. But I think as long as you're just being real and honest with how you're feeling, and then the last thing I would probably say is don't be ever too proud to seek help and support, because that's the best decision I ever made, was to me to be vulnerable enough to go and lean in and get the help, because it's led to me now being on the other end of it where I'm actually providing support for others. So I definitely think two things. Yeah, self-compassion, be gentle and be patient with yourself. If you are going through something, just, I think true strength is being vulnerable enough to reach out for the help if needed.
Absolutely, absolutely. And thank you for that. Thank you for coming on today. I really do appreciate it. Probably the best interview that I think I've ever done in terms of, emotion and advice, etc. So thank you for doing that.
You're very welcome.
Where can people kind of find your socials, the blog, your website, etc.? Where can people kind of reach out and find all the stuff that you kind of preach?
Yeah, sure. So I'm on Facebook, Nathan Arnold Coaching. My website is www.nathanarnoldcoaching.com. I live on Instagram. I love creating content. I can be quite creative with that. And I speak about and share openly some of those personal experiences and try and help people who relate and resonate to some of the messages. So Instagram. Also, I'm on LinkedIn and I'm on Twitter as well. What I would say as well is I on Instagram, the reason why I live there most is because I like to engage with people. And so I do polls often where I'm asking questions. People are then feeding back to me in private. And then on a Wednesday evening, I push out a blog post. So based on the the percentage of people that have got back to me and what are, you know, some of those perspectives on the questions that I ask, I put it into a blog post and I share that with my followers as well, which can be really insightful on certain topics. And also I've just set up what's called, it's called Inspiration Unleashed, which is, I love hearing people's stories. And I think it's so important to have a space and a platform for people to share their story. I think that a lot of the time, a lot of people are just don't have a voice, can't speak up, can't speak out, don't feel heard, don't feel seen, don't feel understood, and they're our basic needs. So I set up Inspiration Unleashed on my website where people can click on that and then it will send you to my email address, and then that's when you can upload your story, share it with me. And I just find it fascinating. I've met so many inspiring people, you know, going from nothing to something in life. And that's certainly a kind of a theme around my own personal journey, you know, meeting that guy in the street, not knowing where my life's going to go, and then being given an opportunity. So I love to hear a little bit of inspiration from others and to provide that space for them to reach out to me. So even yourself, if you get down the line and you've got an inspirational story to share, then please send it in to me. Anybody listening, if you've got an inspirational story, because not only does it help you share your story, I think one big problem that we have in this country, and Americans do this really well, is they celebrate each other.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes we try and keep ourselves grounded, you know, don't get too ahead of our station. And sometimes we don't allow ourselves to fully embrace who we are and celebrate who we are. I think that's something that I'm trying to encourage. So, yeah, anybody listening, if you've got an inspiring story to tell, not only is it good for you to celebrate that and to share that, but also I think you can inspire other people with your journey as well.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Nathan. I appreciate you coming on. And everything that you've done, thank you. And best of luck in the future.
Thanks, Jamie. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so
Take
much.
Care, mate.
Bye.
Bye-bye.